From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Soma.
I'm from Berkeley.
Concord, Cali.
Tenderloin District.
La Mission.
The Mission District.
Noe Valley.
I live in Silver Terrace.
Coming up, the stimulus money's showing up for Bay Area schools, but is it enough?
I mean, we're to the point now, if somebody threw a penny on the ground, we'd be diving for it. We're that desperate, and we put it toward education.
Also, President Obama's nominee for Undersecretary of Education is from the Bay Area, and she's got big ideas.
We're going to see universities participating, community colleges participating at various levels to get to a minimum of at least 1 year of higher education, and hopefully more for a significant percentage.
And maybe you don't recall the 1906 earthquake that shook San Francisco, but we'll meet a man who did. Stay tuned for Cross Currents. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi was in town today. She spoke to the students of Martin Luther King Jr. Academic Middle School in San Francisco about funding education in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, a.k.a. the stimulus plan. She also spoke about the San Francisco Promise Initiative, the one that works to guarantee that sixth grade students in San Francisco's public schools have access to a college education at San Francisco State University. Here's what she had to say earlier today.
The most important thing that California can do is educate its children. That's its biggest responsibility. And quite frankly, something has to be done about how the budget is created in California so that the children are not shortchanged. A budget should be a statement of our values. Our budget nationally is a reflection of our values with a strong commitment to education. The budget in California says it is that, but as we know, the competition for those dollars is just too hard. So I think the whole budget process has to be addressed so that we don't have our children's education paying for other shortfalls that the state has.
That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi speaking this morning at Martin Luther King Jr. Academic Middle School in San Francisco. California schools will get a $1.2 billion shot in the arm next month. That's when the first of the federal stimulus money earmarked for education shows up. The money is a welcome influx for the state's schools. They've been through deep cuts as a result of California's efforts to bridge its $41 billion budget gap. But the federal funds won't work miracles everywhere. Take schools like the East Palo Alto Academy. The majority of its students are low-income English language learners, and they've seen such sharp spending reductions, even the stimulus funds won't make up the difference. KALW's Christy Cole has this report.
Principal Bonnie Billings and her teaching staff face a Herculean task each August. It would be enough just to handle the 80 incoming freshmen arriving at East Palo Alto Academy. But that's not all. Billings says many of those kids show up reading at the fourth grade level.
It's a lot of intense work. The average work week of most of our teachers is 75 hours a week.
Much of that work is spent teaching English. For most students at East Palo Alto Academy, it's not their first language. So they have to learn English while they're studying rigorous college prep subjects like biology. Inside one classroom with charts of plants on the wall and a model of a human skeleton dangling from a hook, students sit in groups of three or four. It's nearly the end of their sophomore year. In 2 weeks, each student will present a portfolio of work to a panel of teachers and parents. Billings approaches a table where two girls sit writing in their spiral notebooks. She asks one of them about the class textbook.
How are you doing with that reading? Is that an easy book to read or is that hard?
It's like in between.
It's in between?
Yeah.
How do you struggle with the most in reading that book?
Like learning the definitions of each word?
The definitions of the word. So vocabulary is difficult, isn't it? Mm-hmm. To figure out what it means.
Billings is unfazed by the girls' confusion. She says it's typical for English language learners.
The area that they're going to struggle with the most is vocabulary development. And so the reading is extremely difficult for them, and we have to provide a lot of extra support to help them with their reading comprehension.
But Billings says that extra attention to help students succeed in their core academic classes may not be there next year.
This is another program that is going to be at risk. After school, I provide a lot of tutors to help them with the reading.
Even with the federal stimulus funds, Billings says she may not have the money to pay for all the classroom support as well as other programs. That's because of California's financial woes. The state passed a budget for the 2008-2009 fiscal year in February, cutting $8.4 billion from K-12 education in the process. Next year's budget is already projected to have an $8 billion deficit. That shortfall may nearly double if voters don't approve three ballot measures next month. And the uncertainty has left California school districts no choice but to let teachers know they may be let go.
It's been 5 years of this since I've been on a school board, where every year we have to go through this.
Unified School District Board of Education Commissioner Norman Yee, speaking at a February meeting at which he and his colleagues voted to lay off some 500 teachers. Yee, like all of his fellow board members, didn't relish this task.
There's something wrong with this process. I mean, we have to basically tell 500 people to be depressed for the next two months or so, not knowing what's going to happen to them.
Boards of education around the Bay Area and across the state have had to take similar action. The Hayward Unified School District has increased class sizes in kindergarten through third grade. The Fremont Unified School District has laid off high school counselors and librarians and teachers. In all, nearly 25,000 layoff notices have been sent in California districts. At the San Francisco School Board meeting, President Kim Shree Moffus said they're just scraping by.
I mean, we're to the point now, if somebody threw a penny on the ground, we'd be diving for it. We're that desperate, and we put it toward education.
Yet educators like East Palo Alto's Bonnie Billings know they're going to be held accountable for meeting the same goals, to bring up state academic achievement scores, but with fewer resources.
So our past budgets, we've been able to provide a rigorous program and high supports. What I'm worried about is now we have to still do the rigor without the supports, and that just doesn't make sense to me. I don't know how the kids will survive in that kind of situation.
The East Palo Alto Academy will lose other programs after this year. In one, students take college-level courses in subjects such as biology and then work an internship with partner companies or other organizations such as the Veterans Administration Hospital. It's helped many of the school's low-income kids land good-paying jobs to help them finance college. That's an investment in California's future. But now, there's hardly any money left to invest. In Menlo Park, I'm Christy Cole for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area. I'm Hannah Baba. The Obama administration has repeatedly emphasized the importance of focusing on the country's educational system, not only K-12, as we just heard, but also higher education. So when the president looked to nominate an undersecretary of education, he looked to community college. For the first time ever, a two-year college chancellor was nominated to that prestigious position. And surprise, or no surprise, she's from the Bay Area. Her name is Dr. Martha Cantor, the chancellor of Foothill De Anza College. I visited her in her office at Foothill De Anza in Los Altos Hills and asked her what her nomination says about Obama's education agenda.
I think the message that the Obama administration is giving to America is a message of inclusion, that all the parts of higher education and K-12 and early childhood need to fit together because we have a pipeline of young people to older adults that are going to need continuous education throughout their lifetimes. The exciting thing about the Obama administration is that they have a real commitment to significantly expanding educational opportunity for Americans, and also on the other side, a significant commitment to accountability that we will get and provide support and incentives and resources to get more Americans educated, more students moving through that pipeline to get that degree, that certificate, so that we can get a competitive workforce back driving America to number one.
What are some of the issues that you think should be the priority for this administration regarding, I know you're focusing on higher education, correct? So what specifically would you like to tackle?
Well, there are several things. First, we have a lot of people who come from low-income, economically disadvantaged families who may not think college is possible for them. And we have support now through the Obama administration to increase Pell Grants for students who want to go to higher education. And that specific opportunity needs to be opened up, needs to be communicated to families. We need to leverage that. And we have had a very complex system of loans and grants so that families have been reticent to really access those resources. So one thing we need to do is make that resource well understood by families so more students can participate and have educational opportunity to enter higher ed. The next thing is we have students who are in higher ed, and we need to do a much better job of getting them through higher ed and out the other side into the workforce. So the Obama administration has said they want to increase by 50% between now and 2020 the number of people graduating from college and or getting degrees and certificates. So, for example, they have said that 1 year of a college education should be the minimum expectation for America. And that means to me, you know, in terms of community colleges and universities, the degrees and certificate programs will train people in higher ed. You may have a year to become an automotive technician. Those are well-paying jobs. Our students are starting at, you know, $60,000 to $80,000 out the door with advanced training in a two-year college. You may go on to, into nanotechnology. Energy, there's a huge national effort toward training solar technicians, energy management technicians, and for students that want to go on and become a civil engineer with a green focus, that opportunity to advance in their careers through all of higher ed would be available as well. So I think we're going to see universities participating, community colleges participating at various levels to get to a minimum of at least 1 year of higher education, and hopefully more for a significant percentage. Another big thing that's related is we have many, many students who are not prepared to enter college from high school. And so we need to do a lot better job of having community colleges and universities work more closely with K-12 so we can identify students that are at risk at earlier stages in their educational career, when they're in high school, when they're in middle school, whether they're in elementary school, and make sure they're better prepared so that they can enter college with the skills that they need. We're doing a lot of remediation, developmental education, basic skills, whatever you call it. It's to get that college prep work done, and we need to get it done faster so students are not falling out. Finally, a big challenge also that we'll be working on is how to reduce the dropout rate in America and get kids on track so that youth to college can be something that is a goal for young people. And families have a big role to play in that, as well as the schools. Our portion, higher ed, needs to support that and say that we have to open up our colleges and universities to be available to young people so that young people see themselves as college students. And I think we can do more on the communication side to allow young people to realize that the universities that are adjacent to them are places that they want to go to, that they'll be able to get into, and that they deserve to be at.
Do you have any specific policies or an idea about how to make higher education less expensive? Because, you know, student loans are crippling these days, and one graduates with a $40,000 or $50,000 student loan, and you know, it's depressing in a lot of situations. What can we do about that, if anything? I know these are tough economic times, but what do you think? What comes to mind?
Well, the first thing is that the Pell Grant's going to be significantly increased for students. And those increases have already been proposed by the Obama administration. They're going into effect right now. And every year there'll be more Pell Grant support. Claiborne Pell was a tremendous, tremendous legislator. And what a gift to young people to have to be able to take advantage of those Pell Grants. That's the first thing. The second thing is I think you'll see more creative combinations of community colleges and universities so students can enter a community college, which would be a lesser cost for them overall, and perhaps use, when they get accepted to that university that they want to go to, use the financial aid loan process to continue and finish. The other thing is industry has a big role to play. So when I think about the things we need to do, we really need to partner with industry, because when students are working in industry while they attend college or university, industry has often come in and helped subsidize a portion of the education, because those individuals who are great employees, very productive, keeping America competitive, they have an investment in those people, and they show that investment over time while they're working and going to school. And I think we'll see more people, and certainly, you know, in my career, over two-thirds of the community college students have to work while they attend college. It's not like it may have been, you know, only for some. I say we're educating the top 100%. And so I think you'll see that combination of industry coming in to really support student achievement. If you look at the healthcare industry, there are models now where hospitals are actually funding the extra cost to enable people who are nursing assistants to ladder up to become RNs in the nursing industry. And if they give back, that's the other thing with civic engagement, if they give back a certain number of years at that particular hospital, then their loan can be forgiven. So I think we have a lot of exciting things to do with industry in the high-demand areas, whether it's technology or healthcare, automotive, where industry can play a role in helping mitigate some of those costs. We want to get people into jobs. That's our, you know, a big thing we need to do in higher ed. And we also want to get people being the great civic leaders in our communities. And that's the other thing, the critical thinking skills that students get in college and the ability to really participate in society. So it's a very exciting time.
And you look very excited.
I am.
So what's the process now? What's happening? You're just waiting?
I'm waiting until the Senate does a review of the application, and hopefully I will be confirmed. So I'm on pins and needles.
That was Martha Cantor, Chancellor of Foothill De Anza College in Los Altos Hills. She's been nominated by President Obama to be Undersecretary of Education. Her confirmation hearings will be held later this month. You're listening to Cross Currents, Context, Culture, and Connection from around the Bay Area. I'm Hannah Baba. San Francisco is world-renowned for many reasons. It's cable cars, Castro Street, Coit Tower, and it's also known for a famous calamity, the earthquake and fire of 1906. It happened just over a century ago Saturday, and it's the subject of our Witness to History.
These are a few of the impressions which I'll never forget.
Individual stories, not simply the way the historian tells the story.
Works which endure come from the soul of the people.
KALW's Holly Kernan brings us back in this piece originally produced for the Great Quake Centennial.
The night of April 17, 1906, the city of San Francisco blazed in all of its cultural glory. The Mission Opera House hosted the world's greatest tenor, Enrico Caruso, performing in Bizet's Carmen. Across town, gamblers and call girls played deep into the night in a district called the Barbary Coast. Just over half a century removed from the gold rush that put the city on the map, San Francisco was the rough-hewn jewel of America's Pacific coast.
Let me paint for you the imperial city of San Francisco, part Paris, part Dodge City.
Journalist James D'Alessandro recalls the Bay Town in his historical novel, 1906.
Literate and boorish, libertine and feudal, a soiled mecca.
It was a very dense community. Lots of buildings, lots of tall buildings.
Karen Brewer is a curator at the Palace of the Legion of Honor.
It was a vibrant retail center, we know, right around Union Square, and there was a financial district. How heavily built up 1906 San Francisco was.
This is, while a relatively small city compared with many, this is a world metropolis. We have all the attributes of a Paris or a Rome or a London, a New York.
That's Robert Falk, a San Francisco denizen of the time. He, along with John Cahill and Charles R. Timby, lived in the city. Their memories were recorded in the 1960s.
We had the same feeling, I suspect, of San Francisco that you have. Whatever that is, we condone what we don't like, but still we love the old town.
So there they are, the night of April 17th, 1906. The end of a day like any other day 100 years ago in San Francisco.
And I went to bed, and the next morning the terrible earthquake came.
On April 18th, 1906, at 5:13 a.m., a moment etched in the memories of all who survived.
And the building I was in jumped off its foundation and wheeled around a bit. When I got up out of bed to open the door, my door was jammed.
Well, I got a terrific shake. So I got out of bed very quickly.
And I hollered to this fellow, I heard him in the hall, push the door in. He said, I can't. If I do that, I'll push the building down.
On the Barbary Coast, chandeliers buckled, tables overturned, and gamblers were hurled from their seats. In Chinatown, terrified occupants clung to their airborne beds as the flimsy tenements burst at their mortared seams, pitched everything and everyone into the streets.
During this time, my clock, odds and ends were on the mantel, were falling down on the floor. Well, I went over to the window and looked down into Curry Street there. Ladies were in their old-fashioned nightgowns. The men were out there, in their underwear. That's the way they slept, I guess, and they were very, very much excited.
The Palace Hotel, with 1,200 sleeping guests, swayed in an enormous circle, grinding and wrenching against its steel bracing. Enrico Caruso woke to the sound of tinkling chandeliers and a sensation of his bed hopping about the room. Along regal Van Ness Avenue, cobblestones resembled popping corn, and the hills undulated like blankets being shaken out by unseen hands.
Many of them fled with literally the shirts on their backs, and so the need for clothing was one of the immediate ones.
And we proceeded to drag those trunks up Gary Street, then up to, I think it was Post to Franklin. We thought we were well out of it. That's where we spent the night. Sitting on our trunks, picked up some blankets, and we used those during the night. And believe me, that was a long, long night.
The earthquake caused tremendous damage, but it was the subsequent fires that destroyed large portions of the city and left thousands homeless.
The place that I lived was burned down. That afternoon, we were ordered by the police or the military to get out. And the fire had crossed Market Street and was headed up our way.
There's complete devastation all around, but people are gathered in clusters observing the fire as it moves up the hill.
I'm standing around watching the fire like the other people.
In 1906, parks and squares were turned into refugee camps and refugee centers.
The city of San Francisco is no more. The Paris of the Pacific, the wealthiest and wickedest of American cities, is now ash and memories.
I remember those nights there, wrapped up in a blanket, sitting on a curb. We had nothing to eat. During these days.
And all of these people had to be evacuated from the area, and many of them were not able to return to their homes.
The night of the earthquake, I'd lost everything I had, my home, The little bank that had my money in it was in ashes. I lost my job and everything.
Do you have a recollection of a historic Bay Area event? Share it with us. Leave a message on our Sound Off page at crosscurrentsradio.org or call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And that's Cross Currents for Thursday, April 16th, 2009, a production of KALW News. The team includes Martina Castro, Allie Budner, Christy Cole, Zoe Corneli, Nathaniel Johnson, Neil Swinkles, and Roman Mars. Ben Trefney is our managing editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Tune in Monday at 5. We'll take you to a place where you can ride history.
It's like you're, as we say, on a museum in motion. These are real antique vehicles, you're riding on a time machine.
That's Monday on Cross Currents. The music you're listening to is La Peña Community Chorus. They'll be performing their spring concert at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley this Saturday at 8 p.m. You'll find a link to that information on our website, crosscurrentsradio.org, and click on local music. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.